So I think instead of restricting yourself just to textbooks and what happens in the class, I mean, there is a life beyond the classroom. There is life at home. There is life with parents. There's life in the larger ecosystem. And I think it's really important to integrate all of this as part of learning, because I think then that goes back to the NEPE, which talks more about holistic learning.
A warm welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, professionals, and of course, philanthropists who are disruptors, yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. While they're ruthless in pursuing their ambition, they don't stray from being leaders who are not just admired for the vision and relentless pursuit, but also for how they're building an ecosystem of believers who consistently push the boundaries. In each episode, I speak to one such leader, talking to her or him or them about their businesses, lives, inspirations, interests, challenges, pivot moments and turning points, successes, failures, and of course, the little joys of life and work. It is as much about their personal life stories as about their entrepreneurial, professional, and philanthropic journeys. Unusual Suspect streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcasts, YT Music, which was earlier Google Podcasts, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms and directories. For this episode, I'm delighted to have Ratna Vishwanathan. Ratna is the CEO of social impact organization Reach to Teach, that is transforming education in India through play-based, inclusive learning models that improve outcomes at scale. She's a seasoned leader with deep expertise in governance and the development sector. She's a 1987 officer from the Indian Audit and Accounts Service. She served in the civil service for over two decades, where she built strong capabilities in strategy, governance, and people management. Ratna eventually transitioned to the social sector and has held leadership roles at Oxfam India, VSO, MFIN, UNEP, and UNDP, among others. Under Ratna's guidance, Reach to Teach has achieved significant improvements in learning outcomes and education across several Indian states. Welcome to Unusual Suspects, Ratna. Delighted to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Gaurav. And I feel equally privileged to be on a show like this because, it's always a great opportunity to be able to talk about the work, the team, the design, the way we approach education, which I think what sets us apart. And that's something I'd like to talk a little about because there are a lot of people working on strengthening education. So how are we different? So these are things I'd love to touch upon. So yes, looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. Let's get started. You know, Ratna, you spent a significant part of your career in civil service before transitioning to the education space. If I may ask you, what prompted that move and how did your experience in governance shape the way you now work with the state education departments and government schools, Ratna?
So basically, Gaurav, I worked with government for 21 years. And during the course of those 21 years, I actually did different things. So I was part of the Audit and Accounts Service, which is the Comptroller and Auditor General. So as a result, what happens is you audit every aspect of the government, wherever money from the Consolidated Fund of India is spent, right? And what that did was give you a magnitude, a ringside view of everything that happened. That was one, and that was massive learning. The second thing is, you know, one thing you learn very well in government is people management, because you can neither incentivize them nor can you fire them. So you have to work with who you have and what you have and try to get the best out of that person. And then, of course, government is very well structured in terms of systems, in terms of processes, in terms of rules. I mean, whether they are actually applied or held in abeyance is another question. But the fact is that iron structure exists. And I think because of that, a lot of work that happens in this country is because of that structure. And I think all of that kind of gave me the wherewithal to look at things from a perspective where I could look at them from a bird's eye view level and yet understand it from ground upwards and at a scale that was really, really large because of the exposure that the service gave you. So that was, in fact, the reason all this systems, processes, governance, etc., is something that I'm very comfortable and conversant with because it kind of became a part of DNA. Now, as to why I wanted to move after working for 2 decades, I really thought I wanted to do something different, something where I would be, yes, policy advocacy is great, making a law is great, creating regulations is great, but you're one removed from people. And somewhere I felt after 20 years that with this kind of experience, if I were to take it over to the development sector and with my understanding of government work through the development sector to be able to, deliver what I call public good, I know it's very cliched, in a manner that would actually create value. And that was one of the reasons I decided to move away.
You know, Ratna, very well said. And you put it very, very beautifully when you said that in the government, what teaches you in the government is people management of a completely different quality and level, because you can neither incentivize them nor can you fire them. So you have to get the best out of them. And I speak this from in the school education system. You were talking about you work with the government schools primarily. And speak this from personal experience, because I also went to a government school, which a vernacular medium government school. So I started writing, speaking in English only when I entered college here. And I know the kind of the kind of inspiration that comes from the teachers in school is something that you only realize when you get out of school, because they have neither the incentives nor anything to keep on working at in the manner that they do, and they're churning out generations of students of very high quality every year. Which is why, my next question is around the narrative that government schools cannot deliver quality, which I, of course, beg to disagree. But Reach to Teach has worked on ground for over a decade, and now at the system level across many states, four, if I'm not mistaken. From that lens, what do you think it actually takes to bring sustained improvement in learning outcomes within government schools?
So basically, Gaurav, I don't agree with the fact that government schools don't impart good education. I think it's more about a structural, it's more like a design aspect in the way the system is used. Because government does provide the system. There are government schools. There are, 54% of Indian children today go to government schools. So they can't not be areas that produce good quality children. But the issue is a little different. Like we did work, first of all, we worked in Gujarat for about 10 odd years, almost 12 years, right at the ground level. So you understood what were the actual issues that, in government schools that impinged on quality of learning, quality of teaching, other structural conversations. So, after about 12 years in 2019, we did a strategy pivot because somewhere we realized that, you can work in pockets of excellence, right? But then they become model schools or pockets of excellence. Now, how do you take them to scale? And if you understand the scale conversation, you cannot take a pilot to scale because the imponderables in doing that transition is huge, and there is no guarantee that your pilot is going to roll out in exactly the same way at scale. So very early on, we realized that to design for scale is very different from creating a design for pockets of excellence. So that is when we decided that after all the learning we had garnered, there was no point holding on to it and just consolidating those point, pockets of excellence, but moving it a notch up and trying to take that learning across to as many children as you could. And that is when we decided that we will work directly with government departments through a memorandum of understanding, because in that case, then we became a partner with the government, right? Two things it does is A, it gives you legitimacy. So you are no longer at the mercy of a local administration or district level, education department official who will decide whether or not you can engage, whether or not you will go into a school, and which is why we thought it's best to get the legitimacy of the government behind you. That was one. Two, regarding teachers, see, teachers are teachers because they like the work that they do. They're not there just because somebody has pushed them into it. But what our system does to them is, and I'm talking about government schools, I'm not talking about any other areas at the moment because that's our expertise. The system makes teachers invisible. Your curriculum, your syllabus, your lesson plan, the textbooks, all of that is decided at a departmental level. With education being on the concurrent list, it's usually the state that decides these priorities, right? So the teacher then becomes a post person who is then told that here, this is the curriculum, this is the syllabus, this is how we want the lesson plans, and this is your year, and you please teach children. Now, there's no skin in the game. That teacher has years of experience. That teacher understands children much more than anybody else does, right? Now, if you do not include teachers in the conversation that goes towards creating learning tools, learning material for children, A, they have no skin in the game. Two, they are not interested. And three, since they don't know what has been created, how are they going to be invested in it? And this is something we realized very early on. So all our work, Gaurav, like especially now that we are working at scale, what we do is we take the government system, the government functionaries at every level of the government department, and they become our feet on street implementing people. So we don't staff up, we use the system, and that's the difference between designing at scale and scaling up. And one of the things that we've done, which I think has really worked very well for us, we've been extremely consultative with teachers, with the departmental functionaries, with the education department to ensure that everything is co-created, co-owned, and there is skin in the game. And it's important to include everybody down the hierarchy because we have a revolving door policy. So senior government officers keep getting transferred. Now, unless you build those relationships, then all the work that you do becomes tenuous at best. So, yes,
Absolutely.
this is what we do.
Yeah, I mean, you have very articulated it very well about the role of various stakeholders and components in the education supply chain, if I may say so. But I would like to now ask you a question on something more fundamental, which is the FLN problem, foundational literacy and numeracy. And we have a peculiar paradox that currently has come to characterize India's education system, particularly primary education, where enrollment rates are very high. It's now comparable with the very best in the world, but our FLN achievements has a lot to be we are far, far away from what we can call comparable with at least the best in the world. In fact, this was flagged by none other than the Prime Minister about 4 years ago during one of his speeches in during the Teachers' Day, where he said foundational literacy and numeracy remains a challenge because many students beyond early grades continue to struggle with age-appropriate skill. Just to understand, how is Reach to Teach tackling this gap and trying to solve this problem in middle and secondary school levels, particularly in states where systemic challenges run very deep?
So Gaurav, like you said, FLN is the first stepping stone to learning. And FLN in India, I think the learning loss that we're talking about now, there is a general tendency to link it to COVID and the learning loss that happened due to children being out of school. But I think in India, it's a little different. It predates that because if you remember, the Right to Education Act very clearly said that children cannot be detained and must be moved up to the next grade. Now, I think what we did not do was back-end it by saying that you must ensure that the foundational literacy and numeracy benchmarks that have been created by the education department must be met before children go on to the next class. So we ended up promoting children, but we did not ensure that they had met these benchmarks. As a result, there is a cumulative loss of learning. And this cumulative loss of learning has led to a big learning outcome crisis in the country today. I think almost 82% children are affected by low learning outcomes, right? Now, the thing here is we are talking of FLN now because, you know, it has been flagged, it has been identified. But like you just said yourself, learning is a supply chain. So we can't look at FLN and then stop there. So when you design, you need to design in a way where it starts at class 1 and ends at class 12. In each link of that chain needs to be equally strengthened. So what we have ended up doing is, especially with FLN, we've realized that children, young children, learn with play. And when I say play, it doesn't necessarily mean toys. It means play in the sense of, you know, how a systemic sense of play. So what we've done, Gaurav, is we've designed, first we do a learning loss survey and we do it ourselves. So what we do is we give children from grades 1, 3, 5, 8 the same questions. By doing that, you assess your learning loss. And FLN is part of that entire process of assessment of learning loss. Once you've done that, what we've done is, and this is because the states we work with have been very, very good in that sense, because unless the state lets you in, you can't do anything. The state and you have to be partners for any system change that you are likely to bring about. And you, particularly in the northeastern states, and I'll give you the example of Arunachal, because there we have now demonstrated evidence of how this model has worked. What we did, even for the FLN classes, was identify the learning loss and created activity and experiential modules within their existing textbooks. And we did this because, as you know, government teachers will not work outside, you know, their hours that have been assigned to them. And children will also not want to come in. And remedial teaching hasn't been a great success. And as a lot of, you know, research has shown. So what we did was we put in activity and experiential based elements into textbooks, linked these to learning outcomes, and to make sure that every teacher across the state taught those activities in exactly the same way, we did two things. We created competency-based student worksheets so that unless the child understood, the child can't answer. And we created detailed teacher handbooks so that the activity was rolled out in exactly the same way across every school in the state. Right? And this we did in consultation with teachers. So by linking activity, indexing it to learning outcomes, and underlining this with this element of play has created a great synergy, because A, children love plays, but so do adults. So there is an interactive element here that gets children and teacher equally engaged in the process of learning. By identifying the learning loss, particularly at the FLN level, we are working to ensure children achieve those benchmarks. At the same time, the classes that have gone by and have missed those benchmarks, the activity elements in those classrooms make sure that these benchmarks which have been left behind are achieved. So children are actually getting to grade appropriate learning within the existing system with the same teachers, just by using a different design element, a different approach, and most importantly, working in collaboration with the education department and co-creating all of this so that there is ownership. And even after we move out, it will become sustainable because it becomes institutionalized within the system.
Absolutely. You know, Ratna, you very rightly said we often focus only on classroom teaching, but organizations such as yours approach also factors in the wider ecosystem, from involving parents, teachers, community members, and even local government bodies. Let me bring you to the National Education Policy 2020, which envisions a child-centric experiential model including ideas like bagless days, etc. How is Reach to Teach helping states translate such ambitious ideas into classroom reality? You did share some examples, but briefly, can you elaborate maybe on one or two more such illustrations, Ratna?
Sure. So one, of course, like I said, including the activity and experiential based elements into work that is happening. Regarding bagless, so bagless is one thing where by very definition, it means that without your bag. But also, if you extend that a little bit, it also means leaving behind your curriculum, leaving behind your textbooks and looking at things beyond the classroom. So the way we have designed bagless is to ensure that there are conversations, there are activities, there are things happening where grade appropriate and age appropriate, of course, where children talk about things that and facilitated with the teacher, where children talk about things that actually bother them. You know, social media, for instance, bullying, things like for the older girls, menstrual hygiene, access to proper infrastructure for them as girls to remain in school. So we have a variety of topics where children either engage with activities, role play, or conversations which are about life. So that is where then you are bringing in the socio-emotional elements, the life skill elements, and all of that in a very subtle way into conversations rather than making it a today is moral science class kind of thing. So I think that has helped a lot. And I think as a model, it works because children like talking. And if they are in a supported, safe environment, they will open up and talk about things that matter to them. So I think instead of restricting yourself just to textbooks and what happens in the class, I mean, there is a life beyond the classroom. There is life at home. There is life with parents. There's life in the larger ecosystem. And I think it's really important to integrate all of this as part of learning, because I think then that goes back to the NEP, which talks more about holistic learning.
Absolutely, Ratna. Let me just change tack a bit. It's about dropout rates, and this is particularly in rural areas where dropout rates for girls, the evidence does suggest that there's a spike after primary or middle school due to safety concerns, sometimes household responsibilities, and sometimes in many cases they're also married off, which is a travesty. Based on your field experience, what are the most effective ways to keep girls in school? And what kind of systemic and community level changes are needed to support their continued education?
So Gaurav, girls being pulled out of, they're not actually pulled out of school. So there's a bit of it's a complicated conversation. If you look at enrollment rates, they're very high. They're 103%, because obviously there's some double counting with migrant children as well. So it's about 103%. And if you look at it, the actual dropout rate is only 12.6%. So if you stand back and look at it, it isn't that large. I think where the missing element is attendance. Because if I'm on the rolls, but I'm not coming to class, technically retention levels are high, technically enrollment levels are high. What is missing? Attendance. If I don't know who's attending, I don't know whether the child has dropped out of school or not, because the name has not been struck off. And this is the tricky area where you play. And this is where, typically after holidays, mothers tend to keep girls back. Then you go and you engage with community and you engage with people to say that these are the advantages of, the girl learning. But you have to, it has to be a conversation, because you can't force these things, right? So it has to be a conversation that is supported not just by you reaching out, but also the teacher, the parents, the larger community, everybody reaching out so that the girl comes back to school. Having said that, you will be surprised that in some states, the dropout rates for boys is higher. And this is because, they at the end of the day, they're a part of the workforce. And this category of schools, the school to work transition is very high. So there is a tendency for boys to drop out after the 8th or the 9th grade and go into businesses that their parents have or the work that is happening with their parents, and they also leave. So for it's not just a girl problem and it's not just a rural problem. Today, I think it's more about, and you're absolutely right about girls being married off early. And that is where those conversations need to be had, that if a girl joins the workforce, the average income of your country goes up by 15%, right? So these are conversations, but they're complex, they're complicated. There are a lot of social norms that kick in. So these are, what will I say, routes that have to be navigated carefully and with a lot of sensitivity.
Absolutely. And finally, Ratna, very briefly, Reach to Teach did make a strategic pivot from running model initiatives in small blocks to now designing for scale at the state level. Of course, you have elaborated this journey in great detail during the course of our conversation, but my question is more about the lessons. What are the biggest lessons that led to this shift?
I think the biggest lessons that led to this shift was you realize that when you work in pockets, so let us say for the sake of the conversation, that if you are impacting 100 children, no matter how brilliant the model you have in place, that impact remains restricted to 100 children. Now, in a country where we're talking about demographic dividend, right? Today, the median age of this country is 28 to 29 years, which means we have a large population that's going to move into the workforce. Now, if 54% of that population goes to government schools and you do not bring up the quality of learning outcomes, and by the way, Gaurav, there's a difference. For instance, an interesting fact, the only two states in the country which are 100% literate are Kerala and Mizoram. But look at learning outcomes. The key is learning outcomes. I may be literate, but have I understood? Can I apply what I have learned? So the crux is the learning outcomes. And somewhere we realize that the only way to impact learning outcomes is to work at scale. Because if you don't work at scale, percentages don't really add up to a national conversation. They are conversations that remain restricted within blocks and districts. I can say I work in 15 states by working in two districts each. Am I achieving scale? I don't think so. Am I achieving excellence in a limited pocket? Yes. Now, when 54% of this country has children attending government schools and we want to reap that demographic dividend, it is absolutely critical that learning outcomes have to be strengthened for this 54% for us to reach any kind of momentum in terms of growth of the economy as we go ahead.
Yes, absolutely, Ratna. Ratna, thank you so much for sharing your deep insights and perspective on a range of issues and taking the time out and dropping by to have this conversation with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gaurav. Thank you so much.